Cassar Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieCassarJane.com. Thank you so much for joining me. I am Hallie Cassar Jane. Today on the Hallie Cassar Jane Show, two masters of suspense. Joining me at my table are writers Dennis Lehane and James Grady, neither strangers to the New York Times bestseller list or to American cinema. But before we begin, a brief message from our sponsors. You are listening to The Hallie Cassar Jane Show. The Hallie Cassar Jane Show is always available online at HallieCassarJane.com and a host of venues, including Blog Talk Radio. And be sure to visit us at iHeartRadio. Today, The Hallie Cassar Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Cassar Jane Show.
Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org.
Hello, I'm Hallie Cassar Jane, host of The Hallie Cassar Jane Show. Join me Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern when I talk with the great artist, writers, musicians, politicians, and celebrities of our day. The Hallie Cassar Jane Show is talk radio for fine minds. Tune in live or listen to the podcast at HallieCassarJane.com. Montana-born author and screenwriter James Grady captivated America with his New York Times bestseller, 6 Days of the Condor. His book turned into the popular film 3 Days of the Condor, starring Robert Redford, Faye Dunaway, and Max von Sydow. Directed by the great Sidney Pollack, the movie became the godfather of modern spy thriller films. Besides working as a screenwriter for CBS, FX, HBO, and major studios, Grady's journalism includes street time as a muckraker for columnist Jack Anderson after Watergate and being a cultural columnist for AOL's PoliticsDaily.com. He's written for a ton of newspapers, The Washington Post among them, and for The New Republic. Now James Grady returns to the character that became a household name, the writer out with a new book, Last Days of the Condor. In this latest spy novel, Grady paints a very modern picture of spies in today's world, including secrets and espionage uncovered by Edward Snowden, WikiLeaks, NSA surveillance, revelations, and more. In Last Days of the Condor, the classic spy codenamed Condor is on the run from everyone. Refusing to just fade away, Condor vows to uncover the truth and is designated an enemy by America's most ruthless national security agency. Good guys, bad guys, it doesn't matter. Every gun is aimed at Condor as he runs for his life with only a faint hope that he can uncover the secret that will save him. Let's talk. So, buddy, listen to me. 1974 to 2015. What, it's been 40 years? You started off, right? You started writing this when you were just a kid. Now you're a grown man who's fathered the list.
I was 23 when I started writing it.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? Now you look back and you say, so like now here you are. Now the father of another one, Last Days of the Condor. Different writing it from this perspective?
Absolutely. So much different. I mean, it's for one thing, you have a sense of what you can do that it might actually end up in people's hands and they might get to read it. That's a powerful, powerful feeling. When I first started out, I was a dreamer. You know, I was a kid living in Montana, hoping that someday, maybe if I got really lucky, 12 or 13 books down the line I'd published, but 6 Days of the Condor was my first one, and now 40 years later, and after about a dozen books, I'm coming back with Last Days of the Condor.
So the world is far less innocent, as you probably are, from back in 1974. Watergate seems tame, doesn't it, compared to where we are today?
We could not have predicted, those of us who were young back then, that we would live in this world that we're in now.
So that, too, had to have changed how you approached all this, yes?
Oh, absolutely. For one thing, when I approached it, there were only 3 nonfiction books on the CIA that you could find. 3. The public's knowledge of the CIA and the intelligence community was really confined to James Bond movies. And while I'm a big James Bond fan, I didn't want to do that. So it was, I was really shooting in the dark. Now you get 150 articles when you Google the CIA, and those are just the ones you'd want to read, not even the further down the list.
Research? How much?
I tend to do a lot of research, but you know, Hallie, I was an investigative reporter for Jackie Anderson for 4 years, and so I actually went out into the streets of you know, really Paris to Los Angeles to Hong Kong. I've been out there and trying to experience this noir world, a spy world, as much as possible, rather than relying just on books. It takes a while, but eventually you find you've crossed the line and you're really out there. And it's a whole different thing than having to rely on Google or the public library.
Let's go back a bit. Born and raised in Montana, the land of relaxation and recreation. My favorite state, by the way. It really, truly is. I love Glacier National Park. But how did a kid from Montana become the king of paranoia and bullet paste ticking clock seconds? I mean, come on. What happened here?
Well, just outside of your favorite place on Earth, Glacier National Park, you go about 60 miles east of there, and you've got my hometown. It was an oil boom and a railroad hometown. Very, very wonderful in one sense, but very violent and very tough in another. And my dad actually managed movie theaters while my mom was the county librarian. So I grew up in this very strange mix of, on the one hand, it's Ozzie and Harriet. On the other hand, somebody takes a shot at my cousin in a bar.
Wow.
It just, the disconnect between what I was wanting to believe and what I was being told was the way things were, and what I was seeing in the streets was so great that my imagination just filled it. And it was the 60s. Paranoia became the way we were when John Kennedy got shot down.
You went to work in politics very young, right?
Yes.
That just attracted you what? You were going to save the day?
Power is always, you know, Hallie, who controls our lives is always, I think, a very important thing. So power had been very an intoxicant for me. And politics was there. It was very personal in a small town. I'm sure our listeners who are in small towns know that politics can be very personal. So it was easy for me to slide in and start seeing how these issues played out. I still feel that there's this kind of bond that I have with politics and with my writing, and that to some degree, one really informs the other. So, yeah, I've been political, I guess, since I was knee-high to a grasshopper.
Said like a true Montana boy. I love it.
You could take me out of the state, but the state's still in me, girl.
I hear you. So, listen, are you an adrenaline junkie who needed a fix and decided to pump it up, and that's what got you back to the Condor? Or maybe my question should be, I know that you've written a whole lot of books, and you just mentioned that, since 6 Days of the Condor, but now you return to Condor, and why now?
Because I kind of wanted to go back to fundamentals. I think as the world gets more confusing, I don't know about you, but the world that I see unfolding in the news every day and you know, I read about and I even see in the streets, it's pretty confusing. And I thought the way to approach that for my readers is to go back to basics, go back to where I started. And suddenly, Condor, who I'd let go 4 decades ago after Robert Redford made him an icon, Condor was there speaking to me and say, we've got to do this again. We've got to do this again. So that was how I ended back with Last Days of the Condor.
So I've got to tell you something. You do know how to get a reader's juices going. I mean, truly you do. The Last Days of the Condor does not disappoint.
Oh, thank you.
It's true. But that being said, back to times are a-changing. You had to address the new world reality. I mean, Edward Snowden, NSA surveillance. I mean, freedom ain't exactly ringing anymore for us ordinary American folks, right? Or any folks, really, I guess.
Yes.
Certainly not for folks in the espionage business. There are 1,000 eyes upon us. And a spy these days needs what? Eyes in the back of their head? What else do they need? It's crazy.
I think they need eyes in every part of their skull. It's just an amazing time when you consider that going to the grocery store to pick up a carton of milk can be recorded by data spies in Moscow. I mean, that's mind-boggling, the degree to which average citizens are involved in spy world thanks to big data and satellites that can read the newspaper that you're carrying on the way to the subway. It's just an extraordinary time, and that effect on ordinary Americans is what I wanted to get to with Last Days of the Condor. I wanted to really show your world is not what we thought it was going to be when we were young.
Hmm. I think that's even an understatement. Do we have a choice, though? I mean, that's the thing. Let's get into that. Do we have a choice? Do we need the surveillance that we have to protect us, or don't we? Where are you on that?
I think that's actually the key question, Hallie. You just sort of nailed it right dead center on target. Whether or not we have a choice is key, but it's also key is what do we choose? We can let systems mindlessly proliferate and multiply themselves like, you know, the common cold in a fourth grade classroom, or we can try and exercise this brand new technology, this brand new world that goes beyond what George Orwell thought of with Big Brother, with our classic American values that still frankly work. I mean, Last Days of the Condor to me is really informed by where I was raised and the American values I was raised in, a little bit of Albert Camus too, but you know.
That's okay.
it's the choices we have to make are really key, and the astonishing thing is we've almost got too much information to make good choices. To some degree, we're just, you know, like playing roulette or throwing dice.
You know, I love that you said that because that's how I feel it is. I feel exactly that. I think that they're just throwing everything out there, hoping something's going to stick. It's craziness, I think. There's got to be some way to rein it in. Listen, I have to ask you. You know that 6 Days of the Condor remains the platinum standard for Washington-based spy thrillers. You do know that, right?
Okay, I'll accept that.
All right. And it's sort of a cultural meme for paranoia. Did that make you paranoid about returning to Condor? I mean, you set the bar, buddy, pretty high on yourself with the success that you had with 6 Days of the Condor, 3 Days, the film. If this is a sequel, you know how much critics hate a sequel? I mean, are you putting yourself out there, buddy?
Because you're absolutely, boy, good question. You're absolutely right. It was, and maybe that's why I waited this long to do it. But, you know, the bigger the risk and challenge, maybe sometimes the more important it is to take it. And I didn't want to play safe anymore. I didn't want to hide from this potential I had. I didn't want to hide from the possibility I had to really zero in with Last Days of the Condor on something important, which is this brand new world that we're all trapped in.
Sounds like a man has truly written the book, not the boy. So I want to talk about Condor.
Okay.
Sexy, cool, yeah. Smart as a whip. You? Talk to me.
Oh, if only from your lips to my reality were that true. I try, boy, this is embarrassing. I try not to make him too much of the James Bond superhero thing. I try to keep him grounded in reality. I do that by not letting him do anything that I couldn't do at my best. So maybe if I were at my best 100%, I could come close to Condor. As for the sexy part, well, you know, I've been working on that for years, and it's still, you know, I can't say that I've gotten it.
What are you, humble or what? I love it. I love it. I love it. Listen to me. How did you feel about Robert Redford playing the part, maybe you?
I found out I was getting on an elevator in New York to meet my editor for the first time, and he was in the elevator, too. Someone else turned and said, hey, I hear that Robert Redford is going to be in that book you guys are publishing called Condor or something. I don't remember the next 20-story ride up to the top of the skyscraper, but it just blew me away. I mean, he's, I think, continuing to be not just a great actor, but an extraordinary force in the art of cinema. I mean, look what he created, Sundance Film Festival.
Right? I love this man.
Over a lot of scoffing and mockery. When he first started that, you could hear stand-up comics. You could see criticism of the press saying, you know, this guy's just trying to do a vanity project. No, here is a man. Robert Redford is not only a true artist, but he cares about it. He's done a lot of good for his arts and industry, and actually a lot of good for things like environmental causes too.
He's a phenomenon. That's what he is. I mean, and he's changed the film business for the better, in my opinion, as we know it. So, question. Hollywood took Condor and turned it into its own? It did, because it always does. I was talking to Anne Rice. She just sold her every book she's ever written to Hollywood, and she's about to have a heart attack about it.
For her, you know?
Right? And she's saying, the first time I go around with vampires, she told me on air, you know, it was a nightmare. I mean, she's whatever. How do you feel about that letting go of your baby?
I've sold several things, although only Condor is the one that's hit the screen so far. Once you make the choice that you're going to do it, it's like driving away from grade school when your kid is going into kindergarten. You just have to hope that everything will be well. And if you get lucky, as I always have, you have a tremendous group of very creative artists who take what you did in one medium and move it to theirs. That means it's got to change. So you do it with trepidation, but you do it with a lot of hope. And I know some writers they complain about it. I never do.
And then there's another side to it. So Redford, you write the character, you put it out in the novel, then it becomes the film. Redford interpreted what he read in the script and in the books, etc. And now you take it back. And I'm curious what happens in your brain. Is Robert Redford now part of that equation when you went to write The Last Days?
You are really good, Hallie. That's you go right to the heart of the issues I had with Last Day of the Condor. I had to do, and you're right, this took an emotional journey, more than an intellectual journey.
I can imagine.
I had to merge the icon that Robert Redford created with the original vision I had. And I think that because I waited all this time to do it, I was able to. I don't think I could have done a Condor sequel 10 years ago, certainly not 20 years ago. But because time has passed, I was able to merge them, and I even account for it to some degree in Last Days of the Condor and the prose. But it was indeed quite a journey for a writer to make.
So there were a number of things that went into play here. One, you'd matured and lived your life for 40 years. And then everything that Hollywood does and the success does to you plays a role in it. And then trying to be true to the character that you created in it. What changes when it was done and you look back and you look at the character now? How is he different?
He's more nuanced. You know, when you're 23 like I was and you're writing a book, my knowledge of just how complex our ordinary everyday lives can be was pretty marginal. I was 23. I think when you as we grow older and hopefully grow wiser, we begin to see the nuances and everything is not so black and white. To be able to bring that kind of maturity into my Condor character in Last Days, and to still keep it a movie in which there are, you know, bad, or a book in which there are bad guys and good guys, that was trickier. That was trickier. I love a challenge. I when I sit down, there are 17 easy things I could write and one hard, and you know I'm going to go for the hard one. So it was this wonderful maturation that I allowed to come out through Condor rather than fought. And you know, Bob Redford's performance was a huge part of that.
Do you like Condor better now, or did you like him the younger man?
I have to tell you, I like him better now because he's less naive and less feckless. I mean, he's more of a serious man, even if he is acting crazy or wisecracking. There's a gravitas to him now that I find much more appealing and much more in common with the people, the ordinary people that I know in my life.
So listen to me. Every spy needs a lady.
Oh, yeah.
Kathy Hale was Condra's lady, as portrayed by the gorgeous Faye Dunaway in the film.
Could I have gotten a better cast?
No, I'm really, Max Manzito, I have to be honest, I watched it again the other night. I hadn't seen it in, you know, whatever. Oh, my God. You know, it holds up.
Oh.
The damn film holds up. It's phenomenal. Yeah.
In fact, it's like I went, wow, how did I know that was going to happen?
I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, and that character of Kathy, she was really ahead of her time.
Yes.
If you think about it. So talk to me about the lady in Last Days of
the
Condor.
Our new lady is, I have a thing for older women. women always have. Women get most interesting after they turn about 45.
Yeah, I think you're my new best friend.
to be able to write a romantic, sexy character who in Last Days of Condor is named Meryl Mardigian, to be able to write her at what I would argue approaching the prime of her life, she's in her 50s, it was a wonderful, liberating experience. And I also actually got to contrast her. I did a much younger woman in her 30s, not to take anything away from the 30-somethings. But the woman for whom Condor is pining and has lost his heart is that wonderful 50-year-old woman. You walk past or you drive past in the street, and then you turn and you look again, and there's just that something special about her. And it comes from having lived. And that's, to me, that's sexy.
Yeah, that is sexy. Well, a seasoned man is always sexy, I think. Never mind a woman. So here's the deal. Some of the things that you wrote in 6 Days of the Condor have actually turned up in the spy world. What?
I was surprised by that. And some of them had some of them that I wrote in Condor then became items in the spiral. Do you know about the KGB?
Yeah, tell everybody else, though.
The KGB, the Soviet spy agency throughout the Cold War, read the book, saw the movie, and thought that what I had Condor doing, reading novels and newspapers and obscure journals, was what the CIA was doing with most of their resources. So the KGB, being a mirror agency of the CIA in some ways, created a secret 2,000-man spy division to do what Condor was doing. And, Hallie, they even came up with this weird-sounding phony name, Don't Ask Me, to try and do the Russian. But it was like a complete nonsense title, and they copied the brass name plaque and put it on the front door of this giant warehouse building in Moscow.
Wow, how weird is that?
Oh, it was stunning. And I didn't find out about this until, I guess it was maybe 6 or 7 years ago. I was out walking our dog, and I'm coming home, and my wife is yelling for me. And is the house on fire? Is one of the kids in trouble? And I'm coming, and she says, you want to take this phone call? And she's holding the phone out there in the darkness. So I take the phone with the dog on one hand in the leash and the phone. And it's the Washington Post calling me for comment on this story. It was one of the most surreal moments of my life.
Almost as surreal as having Robert Redford playing you in a movie.
Absolutely.
You know, my God. Listen, there was another one, too. Wasn't there an Iranian thing?
Yes.
What was that?
1980, there was, right after the Iranian Revolution, when they threw the Shah out, there was a political assassination in Bethesda, Maryland, where the guy stole a mail truck, dressed up in a postman's uniform, put his gun in amongst the packages, rang the doorbell, and when his target opened the door, pop, pop, pop. And it was at the time, I wrote an article for the Washington Star about how strange that was. And then let's call him an intelligence operative who I've known for years, put me in touch with the actual assassin who's still a fugitive in Tehran. And the assassin tells me, he says, well, you know, maybe I stole it from you. Maybe I got the idea somewhere else. But, you know, so clearly the U.S. intelligence community thinks it was copied from Condor. And the killer himself is, well, how much do you want to trust him? So
it's a great story. So listen to me, Montana man.
Yes, ma'am.
We're not alone on this. We're not alone on this interview.
It came out.
That what?
Yes, ma'am. It just came out.
I can't even believe you said it. I was just going to go right back. You've been living in Maryland too long, everybody. But we're not alone. I want to meet your companion. What is your dog's name and what kind of dog is it?
Roxy. Roxy is a rescue dog. We always tend to get rescue dogs. From the tornadoes that hit, I think, South Carolina about 3-4 years ago, she was rescued there. She is so spoiled. She looks like a fox, but with a giant bushy party tail in back and all business up front.
She sounds adorable. I like her. Yeah, well, I want you to know that you're not there. Roxy's not alone because I'm sitting here. I have in the studio today my dogs because I have dog duty today. I have three sitting here quietly, and they're very well trained. Listen to me. You talked about Jack Anderson. And you worked for him, and how lucky were you? And you've written, God knows, for every magazine in the world and every newspaper at one time or another. But here's my question to you, which is, what do you see as the state of journalism today from your bit?
It's something I bemoan every morning when I go out and I pick up my two newspapers, and they're half the size right. of one. We are evolving, perhaps in some way, journalism was the cutting edge of the evolution of how much things have changed. I worry greatly. I long for the days when the press was responsible and worked hard, and there was no shouting from the reporters themselves or from the television commentators. It was an era when the idea that you had to get as close to what was true as possible made you get up excited every morning. I hope that whatever we're moving to now can retain some of that spirit. The idea, you know, Thomas Jefferson said he would rather see a nation with newspapers and no government than with a government and no newspapers. And I kind of tend to feel that way too. The free press and to some degree which you represent is so crucial to how our democracy functions and how our daily lives are. So I'm hopeful because I try to be a hopeful guy, but man,
it's scary out there.
It's scary
out there with the leaks and then publishing. Where were you on that? I'm curious.
Well, as a reporter for Jack Anderson, I actually received a lot of leaks. What scares me are the wholesale leakers. When a whistleblower would come to me, he would come with a very specific constrained problem. They're stealing money in this Pentagon program and hiding it under the top secret stamp. You've got to stop it. It was very specific. It was to me, there was a check and a balance. And yes, I nobody elected me, but if I made a mistake, I would be sued or go to jail. So there was a check on me there. When you can just go online and dump not five stories, not 500 stories, but say 50,000 documents with the push of a key, that scares the hell out of me. I don't see how you are accomplishing getting relevant, important information out to change things for the better. What I see happening is
revenge
or or show off, you know. Oh, look what I can do!
Right,
I don't know. It makes me very nervous. I think that some good has come from both Manning and Snowden, but I'm very nervous about the process that they went through. And I tell you, for an old muckraker like me, it really puts you in an emotional and a philosophical bind.
I'll say. We could be arguing this one for the next 400 years. I don't know if we'll ever get the right answer. And I don't think we have control anyway. That's the part that's so scary. It isn't even so much what's happening, is that we don't have control over it, because anybody can get in there and get anything that they want to get. Welcome to the new world.
Yeah.
So listen, turns out this new wonderful book of yours, Last Days of the Condor, has been picked up, right?
Yes.
MGM Paramount's optioned it.
Yes.
Okay, so who's going to play? Who do you want to play? You have to play with me. Who do you want to play?
I would, oh, You know, the great thing is, look at, there are actually so many great people. There is, of course, this guy named Robert Redford. You might have heard of him. he's still out there acting. I mean, you have Robert De Niro, who's extraordinarily a Neeson. You have Jeff Bridges, who Jeff Bridges walks past in the background of a movie, and I can't take my eyes off him. There's such a large number of wonderful actors out there who could take this role and really make it their own. That I daydream about it, but I try not to.
So who did you have in your mind for the girl?
Oh, for the girl.
I'm wondering. Oh, you don't. You have to think about it, which means you didn't have somebody in mind when you were writing.
Actually, I one of the things I do is I try and
your wife.
Construct an image. Well, yes, my wife Bonnie, brilliant, beautiful, but not quite right for this role. I would say that. Again, there's a large number of incredible actresses, and I'm right now blanking Susan Sarandon, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she
can do anything.
Is exactly the right age and exactly that right kind of, you know, humorous but still sexy and cynical temperament. I mean. She would.
You're getting excited.
Sarandon in my mind, and I,
You're getting excited. Listen, your title, "The Last Days of the Condor," that's ominous.
Well, I wanted to give myself with last days. Actually, my wife helped come up with that title. I wanted to say that I'm not fooling around. You know, this is I'm not baiting and switching. This is that we are in an era where the fiction that I want to write and that I want to, and the issues I want to deal with, this is our chance. This is our time, and I want to emphasize that from literally word one right through to the end. And the title had to be powerful and convey that with some honesty. And last days just. My wife looked at me and said, you've got to call it Last Days of the Condor. And when my wife says something, I tend to listen to her very carefully.
smart man. See, something you did learn in all those years of growing up and maturing. I kind of like that. What next? Do you know?
Well, I've been doing lately an awful lot of fiction for what they call charity anthologies, for example. I just was in a charity anthology to help veterans with songs, stories based on the songs of Bruce Springsteen. I did one for landmine eradication. I've got a couple short projects that I want to do. After I finished Last Days, I was spent. I wanted to take a breath before I jumped into the next novel. I'm working on some Hollywood projects, but really, when you come out with Last Days of the Condor, you better take a breath before you move on to your next one.
I've been speaking with James Grady, author of the new spy thriller, Last Days of the Condor, by way of Tor Forge. For more information on the book and on James Grady and his other works, be sure to visit his website at www.jamesgrady.net. Born and raised in Dorchester, Massachusetts, Dennis Lehane is the author of 12 novels, most recently The Drop, and the New York Times bestsellers Live by Night, Moonlight Mile, Gone Baby Gone, Mystic River, Shutter Island, and The Given, as well as Coronado, a collection of short stories and a play. A Drink Before the War won the Seamus Award for Best First PI Novel. Mystic River won the Anthony and Barry Awards for Best Novel and the Massachusetts Book Award in Fiction from the Massachusetts Center for the Book. It was also a finalist for the Penn Award. Live by Night won the Edgar Award for Best Novel and the Florida Book Award Gold Medal for Fiction. His stories have found success on both the page and the screen. The film adaptions of his novels, Mystic River, Gone Baby Gone, and Shutter Island, have all gone on to become blockbuster hits in Hollywood. The film rights for Live by Night are under option for Warner Brothers, with Ben Affleck producing, writing, directing, and starring. Lehane was a staff writer for HBO's The Wire and is a writer-producer on HBO's Boardwalk Empire. Now he's out with a new novel, World Gone By. It's been 10 years since the former crime kingpin, Joe Coughlin, lost his wife in a rain of gunfire. Now Joe lives his life deep in the shadows as a consigliere to the Bartolo crime family in Tampa. There he tries to raise his son Tomas in peace, traveling between Tampa and his son's native Cuba during the height of World War II. Ever the operator, Joe moves easily between the black, white, and Cuban underworlds, crossing paths with Tampa's social elite, U.S. Naval Intelligence, the Lansky-Luciano mob, and the mob finance government of Fulgencio Batista. He has it all, money, power, a beautiful mistress, and anonymity. But then word arrives from a prison inmate that someone has placed a contract on Joe's life. Trying to ferret out both the killer and the man who hired him, Joe takes the reader on a ride through the growth of the mob during a world at war, which leads us from a masterfully choreographed Ash Wednesday gun battle in the streets of Ybor City to a chilling, heartbreaking climax in a Cuban sugarcane field during which all the worst truths are uncovered, and the wages of a lifetime of sin are finally paid in full. Let's talk. You've been busy, very busy, writing a game. You're in the writing game for a very long time, blockbuster after blockbuster. So now the birth of a new baby, World Gone By. Do you get the jitters wondering what the press is going to think or what people are going to think? Do you still get into the jitter thing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't send a child out in the world and not want them to be loved.
Do you get hardened? Do you get hardened? Okay. Does it get any easier as you go along?
I mean, sure, your skin gets a little thicker, but I don't know that, you know, it's much easier. And the writing, I believe, gets harder.
Oh, that's interesting. So let's talk about In World Gone By, and we'll talk about that writing in a minute. You return to the epic story of Joe Coughlin, who made his debut in The Given Day and returned when Live by Night. What's it like for you to return to an old familiar character? Is it the comfort of getting into bed with an old lover, or does it have the excitement of a torrid affair? Which one is it when you return?
Oh, I think it's with this case, it was with Joe, it was it was somewhere in the middle. I mean, I'd never thought of these as a series of books. It's three standalones connected by a bloodline. So it's different Joes we meet. We meet Joe as a child in The Given Day. We meet Joe as a young man on the rise in the gangster subculture in the 1920s in Live by Night. And then, you know, we meet him as a more august fellow in World Gone By. He's middle aged for the time period. He's 37 years old. And in 1943, that meant you were middle aged, and so he is. He's looking at his world at a moment when the sins of the past are beginning to catch up. They're beginning to accumulate.
So, does he evolve as you evolve as you gallop through life?
Not exactly. He's not quite my doppelganger, but he's a vehicle for me to look at two things I was really interested in. One is which is the sort of history between the world wars, and then of America. And then two, it's, yes, I'm middle-aged. I'm starting to, we're at the age right now where we're going to the funerals of a lot of our parents. So myself, my friends, my wife. So suddenly you're aware that the world you know is being swept away, and that's really what this book is about.
How do you feel about that world you know is being swept away, Mr. Lehane?
I feel bittersweet. Of course, mm-hmm. I never want to be that fuddy-duddy who says, "Well, in my day." but at the same time, you think, you know, this was a world I knew. This was a world I knew, and it's gone. That's in big ways and in small. And I think every generation goes through that. Every single generation since the dawn of time. I think in the first century AD, there was some guy who was, well, middle age then was probably 22, but there was some guy thinking, oh wow, it's all changing. It's all changing.
Yeah, it's a strange thing that happens in life, isn't it? Listen to me. More than any other writer in recent times, I got to tell you, your work is unique and it has a very distinct flavor. No matter how the story might change or the characters, a Dennis Lehane work, it's like a certain je ne sais quoi. I don't even know what to put on it. Is it your upbringing that seeps into the literary landscape of one of your books, or what? Or can you put your finger on what you think it is that makes your work so unique?
No, I don't know what it is. I know that it's a weird inability to tell any story except the one that has just seized me. And so I basically blew away any concept of a brand, as they say in publishing, 10 years ago. And then, which made it very difficult in some ways for my publisher to know how to sell me. But then recently, a friend of mine, I was worried about it. I remember a couple of years ago, and I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said he was a writer. And he was beginning to look at me with something approaching rage. And he finally said, "You don't get this. Nobody else has your career. Nobody." And I thought, oh, that's really nice. That's really nice. He's like, "Yeah, we all want to be you." He was a young guy. And I said, "Well, that's so sweet, you know, and now I don't worry about it." Basically, I've created whatever a Dennis Lehane novel is, it's its own thing. And I'm really happy with that. And it's allowed me to have this very interesting, somewhat less predictable career.
So when you start a book, does it just go from the heart, or is there a part of you that wants to create a certain flavor?
Well, anytime I go into a book, the first thing I want to do is I want to make the book evocative. And that's where you're getting the idea of flavor. You know, I want you to be immersed in my books. I want to use every single trick in my holster, every bullet, everything I got to make you feel completely immersed in the dream that I'm trying to create for you as a reader. And so yeah, that's I work pretty hard at that, as you should, you know.
Absolutely.
And then
you do it well.
Well, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
I just want to give you I want to entertain in the greatest Aristotelian sense of that word. I want to take you on a journey, and hopefully by the end of that journey you come out feeling at least for a moment slightly changed.
You hail from the streets of Dorchester, Massachusetts. I want to ask you a question. How do you see
the house? It wasn't like in the street.
Well, I'm glad to see it. Is that my illiterate nature coming through? How do you see the world? Is it a tense place, a dangerous place, a dark place? Listen to me. Is it a Rembrandt world, a Picasso painting, a graffiti? Tell me about that.
It's everything. I think it's all of those things. I think it's a very dangerous place. I think it's also a very wonderful place. I think it's a very hopeful place. And then catch me on another day, I think it's a very hopeless place. It's certainly a very corrupt place, but sometimes there's levels of corruption that I find charming. So, it's all of these things, and it has always been thus. It has always been thus.
Level of corruption you find charming. What a strange line that is. Talk to me.
Well, I think there's a moment in the given day, actually, where I kind of sum it up, where these three marginally corrupt politicians are talking about their own corruption. And one guy's giving the other guy a hard time for buying a boat. So after he just built a house, and he says, "Why would you buy a boat?" And he says, "So I can sit and look back into my house." And he says, "Oh, you love the trough." And the politician says, "Yes, I do, boys. I make no, but these others out there, they're not going to be satisfied until they get the whole world." Mm-hmm. And that's the difference in corruptions. I don't mind mildly corrupt people.
It's what makes the world go round.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
It is.
Yeah,
exactly.
For sure.
And if you think of the world any other way, give me a break.
Right, exactly.
But it's the people who want everything. It's the people who have a scorched earth policy by which they just want it all. And they are willing to destroy cultures to get it. That I find an evil. And in a world in which the books of my world, you can see, I mean, the world of my books, you can see I rarely judge my characters. But if you find evil in my books, it's usually that sort of the rapacious and bottomless greed that will show up as an evil in most of my works.
And intrigues you. I love the fact that it intrigues you. Raw, That's how I always feel after reading one of your books or seeing the film version of one of your books. It leaves me utterly raw. You light a reader's sense on fire. Are your senses on fire?
Yeah, they should be. If I'm doing this well, you know. Look, it's funny. I have a friend, George Pelicanos, and he's a great writer, and we came up together, and we're both the children of immigrants and who worked really hard, our parents. And so when we hear writers complaining about how hard it is, we roll our eyes. And sometimes we do even worse than roll our eyes. You want to know what hard is? My father worked 32 years for Sears and Roebuck, and I'm quite sure that the glamour of that job went out about month four. But he did it to support his family. I get to make stuff up for a living, and these lunatics pay me for it. So I will never complain about my job. So having said that, I will say that the job should be hard. It should be very hard. If you're doing this well, this should be a hard job. And it should take a lot out of you, emotionally, psychologically, in terms of your time, in terms of your commitment. You should be fully committed to doing this.
You know how some people are visual people and some people are tactile people? Which, taking those senses, which one is the ruler of Dennis?
Probably the visual at the end of the day. I mean, I love tactile too, but
glad to hear it.
I'm really visual. I've got a very active eye.
Well, you know, I've always said that writers are just paint with words. That's, you know, there are people who paint with crayons, and there are people who paint with words, and you do that. And I think that that is one of the things that's so brilliant about you, because when I said that to you about not just being raw, but when you know there is a certain painting that is Dennis Lehane's talent. And that's why I was going there with you.
I will take that.
Well, do that. You're also very good, by the way, unlike a lot of writers, at interviews. Were you like a character in school? Why are you so good at this? Most writers are introspective, and you're like out there, just, you're adorable.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very sweet. Yeah, it's funny. We're watching it all play out with my daughter right now. Yes, I was very much a class clown. I was always getting in trouble. And I always had a very gregarious personality. There's two parts of my personality. One is very gregarious, and the other is very leave me alone.
Leave me the hell alone.
I had a dog, and I think that dog was exemplified my personality. He was a bulldog, and when I took him to the dog park, he would be straining on the leash. He literally once jumped through the car window to get to the other dogs. He would run up. He would get to every dog. He would sniff their butts. He would say hello. And then he would walk off on his own.
Cute. Cute dog. And, cute. And I like a man who likes a dog.
That's my personality.
And I like a man who likes a dog. Right. I get that.
Oh,
I totally
well, then, good. Because really? Because my wife's really trying to, she's at her wit's end with our current dog, who's mine.
So. No. Dogs are important. Animals are important. And how people relate to animals tells you an awful lot about who those people are, by the way.
It really does.
Right? So listen, also, you're a legend in your own time. You are.
Yeah,
it's
true.
You are. And I want to know how that affects things. I mean, you know you're on the top of your game. How does that affect how you work? Does it get in the way?
Because, again, we're back to this idea of branding. I think that I've carved out this niche for myself that is very nice, but I'm not a mega bestseller. I'm not a huge author. My name is well known, but in terms of, you know, my connection beyond my sort of base, which is a wonderful fan base, I've never really exploded beyond that. And that's great. That's perfect. I like that. But I don't end up thinking, oh, I'm a legend, or people know who I am, or people know what I'm doing. No, none of that. My God. The moment a thought like that flashes in my head is usually when my wife will come over and say, you know, dog just took a crap in the dining room again. You know.
Puts everything in perspective, darling, right?
Yes. Throw the roll of paper towels and the floor cleaner at me. I mean, that's, you know. So I think it's funny. I tell the story of this, the ultimate perspective to me on any idea of celebrity, whereas there was once a point where I was talking to the quarterback, Tom Brady, because our kids were going to the same school. So we were talking, and all of a sudden Tom says to me, in the middle of this conversation, he just says, what route do you take to get here? And I tell him, and he goes, yeah, you know, I've tried that too, but the traffic's just awful, man. I mean, it's just, he goes, I'm just trying to figure out a way around this traffic. And it occurred to me, Tom Brady sits in traffic.
Right. That's and a couple of other places he sits as well.
We never realize about celebrity. We somehow think they're flying above everything.
Right. Yeah.
But
yeah.
No, they're just regular people. Everybody's just regular people. It's just some of them actually a little bit more well-known.
Joe Coughlin in World Gone By, Florida, Cuba, the Cuban underworld, World War II, money, power, women. Whatever world Dennis wants to play in, he creates. Having fun creating, Dennis?
Yes. Yes. That's, again, we're back to that same idea. I can't believe people pay me to do this.
I've been speaking with author Dennis Lehane, out with his latest winning novel, World Gone by way of William Morrow. For more information about Dennis Lehane, visit his website at DennisLehane.com. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. Oh, and while you're at HallieKasserJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieKasserJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.